The rural areas, if we exclude traditional leadership, the house of traditional leadership should, and let me just say, be very frank here, that in terms of the list of stakeholders that the commission has, as the primary stakeholders, that house is not there. So, Tanya, I think I must say that we will take it upon ourselves to actually make that House of Traditional Leaders one of the primary stakeholders of the Commission at the same level as the National Parliament and the Provincial Legislatures and the Municipal Councils. So I have absolutely no answers to the questions that you raised that are related to the exclusion of the House of Traditional Leaders. And I must agree with you that that creates a serious gap in terms of the views that you are reflecting. It's reflective of probably how we work as technocrats, as government sometimes. Rural areas, basically, we look at as there's a little center here, and it's an apt example that you are using. If you are in Mtata, you are not in a rural area. And it's an apt example that you are using that I think all of us, I think from my side, I would basically want to reassure you that as a commission, the approach will basically change. It's a flawed methodology, and I agree with you fully. So I'm not going to, I will ask Tanya if she needs to add a few things to some of the questions, the numbers that you ask, to add to that. But otherwise, I agree with you fully that there is a weakness in this whole approach. Let me then go back to some of the key questions. Let me also respond to the Honourable Member there. I was trying to understand the question. Now, if I must maybe correct what I think might be presenting a little bit of a confusion, is the fact that on these documents that we have circulated, there's a document that says Financial and Fiscal Commission recommendations since 1995. And then in that document, I actually focused, as requested, on those recommendations that were rejected since 1995. Now, those recommendations have no direct relationship to the public hearings that we are basically talking about. So the public hearings are the ones that are addressed in the slide PowerPoint presentation that Mr. Mahabir here and Ms. Ajam basically spoke to. Now, I am not sure whether that actually then clears your clarity-seeking, what I consider was a clarity-seeking question, but if it doesn't, then I will come back to it. And then the issue of... let me say, I will let Tanya speak to the issues that the Honourable Member over there asked around the bottlenecks, around the title deeds and all of that. I will also allow Tanya to, let me say, I'll allow Tanya to respond to most of the housing issues. But let me talk about the issue of the devolution of powers and functions and the DECOG process of 2009. We did get a request to make a submission on that process on those areas that are directly related to the Commission's mandate. So we did make a submission, and as you correctly say, we have no idea what actually happened. In fact, what we are aware of is that there is a similar process that has started. We have been briefed basically on that process. It was early to mid last year that we interacted with the department, and they basically, when we asked about the other process and where it is at, we were told that that process was abandoned. That's what we were informed. I am, however, going to be meeting with the Director General, the Acting Director General of Department of Cooperative Governance on Friday to discuss some of those issues, where they are at and where we must find ourselves fitting in on that. The issue around the optimizing versus the maximizing of property, was it property rates that you were talking about? I think the idea basically is to accept that in government, the point is not about maximizing. The point is raising sufficient resources at the margin. So I think the use of the word optimize is in that context. It's not like you want to squeeze as much as you can. You want to get sufficient, which is in line with the potential given the rates that you have. With the what is the potential that you can raise? So if you are 95% or 97%, you are doing fine. If you are 40%, then you are not doing very well. So you are not operating at an optimal level. I think that's the key message there. With respect to the data gaps, the issue here relates to for us as a commission. It's problematic because in terms of our legislation, the data that we must use is official data. So the data that we must use is data that Statistics South Africa and government has put their stamp of approval on. So you might have very good data, for example, the Bureau of Economic Research, Human Science Research Council, all of these institutions have their own ways of conducting these surveys and collecting data. So even private sector bodies also do that. But we can't actually use that data in terms of the law. So the only way in which we can sensitize the data story is to basically make the kind of recommendations that we make. And if you look through this submission, you'll find that we have made quite significant inroads in getting government to collect data that otherwise would not have been collected, just to respond to the system. Because what we need to accept is that before 1994, there was a completely different type of a system of government. Now, Statistics South Africa was created to serve that kind of a government. So the kind of information that was being collected at different levels from what we would actually require. So right now we require data, for example, at a school level or at a hospital level, whereas in the past they might not have actually required that kind of data. So if you look at some of the requirements in the Division of Revenue Act, the kind of information that needs to be published in order to get this grant or to get that grant, is that kind of demand for information. But you can only create it, it can only emerge if there is a demand for it. So we try to work through the system in that particular fashion with them. I think there's an issue around this, the census, the 11-year census, especially given what I said was about 95-96% dependence on the transfer formula on population or demographic statistics. Now, if your census is an 11-year census, it becomes quite problematic. And I think in one of our submissions last year, we basically referred to the fact that we need to go back to the five-year kind of a census, because if it's like this, then we might have to dilute the dependence of the formulas on population or demographic statistics. The issue of the municipal infrastructure grant and operational and maintenance issues. I agree with you fully, Honorable Smith, that there have been these discussions around saying you will leave this amount for maintenance and in these grants. But it is just that. What actually happened is that now it's a percentage of your budget. It's not necessarily part of your MIG. It's not a hard and fast rule. It's a, what do you call it? What is it called?
Guideline.
It's a guideline. That's not a hard and fast rule that forces somebody to do that. In terms of our own work, what we find is that most of them, basically it's less than 5% that they allocate to maintenance and operation. And that's got serious implications for your backlogs component, because you now have these ongoing backlogs that are resulting directly from lack of maintenance. And so it's something that we believe that needs to be really looked at. Where the debate ended, if I may, it actually got to a point where this grants, you then said leave a certain percentage for capacity building. That one is a hard and fast one, so it's about, I think it's about 8% as well, for capacity building. That's what you have. Otherwise, the maintenance and operation, it's just a percentage of your budget. Let me say that in terms of the FFC's views around rural areas and rural municipalities, the Commission is very clear that we really need to focus more attention on rural. There's quite a lot of focus on cities, and mainly because the cities themselves have also come together and got together and put together a pressure group. And so that pressure group can actually raise the issues of the cities. Now, we even, in terms of the finance processes, we even have a forum now which is convened by the National Treasury, which is a technical committee on finance for the cities. Now, what happens with the rural municipalities, that's a completely different game. So somebody else must champion the needs of rural municipalities. And definitely, I am not sure that the Department of Cooperative Governance or SALGA do a fine job in doing that, but maybe they do. But those are supposed to be the champions there. Now, for our part as a commission, we have taken decisions. Even as I speak now, there are projects that we are running that are focusing directly on rural municipalities and what needs to be done in terms of a wide range of issues, including climate change issues. So it's a wide range of issues that we're trying to deal with respect to municipalities. So we have specific projects that try to address the rural economy. And I certainly want to empathize with the issue expressed by Honorable Mandela as well, that it's problematic to expect people to move because they expect that if they move, they will get a house. So the issue of migration or urban-rural migration is something that as a commission, we would like to see it reversed. But it requires a substantive also change in the structure of the South African economy. And if the rural economy is not resuscitated, it's going to be very difficult to stem the push factors for migration. Honorable Mashoba, I think we will do that. You have asked the Surveyor General. No, I think that's very clear what needs to be done on to. There were questions around the criteria for qualification for an RDP house, regulating the allocation of houses that relates to multiple ownership of and who actually occupies an RDP house. Let me answer that by giving you an anecdote. In 2008, I had a meeting with the then mayor of Ekurhuleni, and we were discussing the issues that were confronting Ekurhuleni as a metro with an aging population and what the future prospects for a metro like that look like. And also like the old type of industrial hub of Johannesburg or South Africa. So you got all of those things that in the future might actually be disappearing. And one of the issues that he raised with me was the issue of a market that is developed for RDP houses. Now, the market for RDP houses, as you say, is linked to very intricately to the informal settlements. So there are people that actually control or that ensure that informal settlements actually exist. And then the informal settlements feed into the formal RDP houses, and then there are people that basically are benefiting from that, the slumlords or whatever you call them. So there's a market there where people actually even kill each other for that. So that's the extent of the problem at an anecdotal level. So what you are saying is that there are people that might own two or three RDP houses that drive a RAV4s or whatever. They are renting. The owner of the RDP house is probably back in a slum somewhere. And then he's got joined another queue somewhere. And he's actually... So this thing keeps feeding itself. And obviously, there are issues around control. How do we control for those kinds of things? But for the commission, I think that's a question that somebody else needs to be responding to. Because like I said at the beginning, that it's important that when we do some of these things, we actually have minimum kinds of standards that we actually put in place at a national level and at a provincial level that would actually be fitting into what actually happens at a local level where we actually observe these kinds of things. And so I think I want to agree with you that there's a problem there, but it's a problem that the Department of Human Settlements must actually be addressing. I think it is a genuine problem which though requires quantification. What is the extent and what is the cost to the state? We need to quantify it in an objective way. And so those are issues that one can actually be looking at going forward. Can I ask Commissioner Ajam to respond first, and then Mr. Mahabia will take the other question.
Okay. There was a question on the title deeds figures. Like, why are we seeing decreases in title deeds, and it appears to arise from two sources. Okay, one is the inefficiency of the deeds office itself,
But there also seems to be an issue with the conditionality of grants, because prior to 2004, contractors could only receive payment once they had transferred the actual title deed. Apparently in 2004 that was relaxed, and the minute that was relaxed, you started seeing some of the decreases. So I think that we should go back to making sure that payment is actually contingent on the transfer of the title deed as well. There was also a question on the breakdown of the 70,000 hectares of state-owned land that was identified. Unfortunately, we don't have the breakdown here. The figure was arrived at in the context of the National Housing Corporation's strategy. They might have done more work or released more information on just where those hectares are located. So what we will do is we will go back and see if we can provide you with that information. There was a question from Peter about property rates. I think the question was, why do we say optimize property rates as opposed to maximize? And I think that there are two issues there. The one is actually collecting what is due to you, right? In other words, implementing the rates policy, which was agreed to by council. The second set of questions revolve around, you know, what is an appropriate rate to set for property tax? And you really have to bear that is in mind, that there's a balance between residential, commercial, and industrial. And so, you know, it might seem, okay, let's just like slap it on industrial policy properties, but that might be detrimental to local economic development. So you have to look at those balances. But most importantly, what you can do in terms of property rates is inextricably linked to the quality of your service delivery. Right? You can't be jacking up property rates if you can't even bill people properly and you're billing them for stuff, you know, that, you know, water that they never used or electricity that they never used. So you have to, when we say optimize, we're actually trying to bear all of those factors into consideration. I think you also asked the question on densification. We mentioned it, but it wasn't highlighted again. I think that maybe it was because we received so much feedback that we had to try and rationalize in the report. But it did come up again. Basically, what stakeholders felt is that we should be looking at 2 to 3 story densification. So not densification where you need lifts, but where people can actually walk up. And we should also be looking at pooling subsidies. So instead of saying, as I said before, like one plot, one dwelling, you know, maybe you could have 2-story dwellings and pooling of subsidies. The point is that the minute you go to densification, it does actually increase your short-term costs, but your long-term fiscal cost and environmental cost is much less. So, you know, that's one area that we will have to look at in grant design. Then the Human Settlements Housing Guarantee Fund, that was announced in the budget speech. The minister's budget speech. I don't know if colleagues have more information on that, but I think we can look. If my colleagues are not certain, we can get back to you. I think the interesting question there is, what is the scale of the fund? Is it big enough to make a dent? But once you have a scale, like a large scale guarantee, how do you deal with the fiscal risk? Because then you might get into a scenario like the United States, where you have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right? So I think that that is definitely an issue that the FFC would want to look at in more detail. Just want to agree with Bongani, this mandatory maintenance is not part of conditional grants. And I think that what's important is you get two types of maintenance. You get routine maintenance, right, where you're just like painting a building, whatever. Then you get rehabilitation. And what happens is, if you defer your routine maintenance, it means that you actually have to practically rebuild that asset from scratch, right? And what we've seen is that there's been such deferral of maintenance that you're really in rehabilitation territory rather than in routine maintenance territory. So to say, this is going to be funded from operating budgets, doesn't seem to really make sense. So I think that the issue of maintenance is something that we definitely have to look at. Then you asked a question about the cost of services. My understanding is the tenor of the question was, even if you look at the FFC's figures of 175, those figures are now out of date, given that they were 4 years that this was done 4 years ago. Now, Jugal actually sits in that technical committee, and I'm going to let him answer it in a technical way. But I'm going to give you the non-technical bottom line, right? That formula, even though it uses absolute amounts for service delivery, right, doesn't, one would think that it adds up the total cost of service delivery and basic service to the municipality and then gives the municipality that amount. Actually, that's not the way the formula works. What the formula works is it actually calculates those amounts, then it applies an adjustment factor. And it says, what do we need to do to get all of these amounts to fit into the pool that's available for the local government equitable share, right? So what it actually ends up with is almost giving municipalities a slice of the cake. So it's saying we will use the cost as a variable to determine the relative size of the cake. But whether that actually covers the cost of service delivery or not, right, okay, that may or may not be the case. And I think that in the FFC, we've always felt that the formula should be linked to the actual costs of service delivery. And we need to look at cost disabilities. And so that's one area where government has not really taken up our recommendations. And I think that it is one area that I would like the committee to really follow up on. I think it's that area.
Just clarify something. I know you always had this thing about the cost and norms approach, which is being rejected as well, and I can kind of understand why they're rejected. But is this 130 a national aggregate figure? Okay, thanks.
Okay, then, the question that you asked, there was a question on MIG and the LES, and the question went, if I understand it correctly, is there's no link now between MIG and the LES. So MIG is going to roll out infrastructure, but the maintenance is going to have to be funded by the recipient municipality. And the question that you were asking is, well, then what happens to municipalities who actually don't have excess capacity? And I think that that's precisely the issue. When you have a municipality like Emakazeni that's actually getting clean audits, that is optimizing their revenue, they're collecting what is due to them, but structurally, that falls short of what they actually require. So I think that that's a huge issue, because you want municipalities to expand capital works, because that's where you get new underserviced households to experience it. But unless you actually make sure that you also deal with the operating side, you could actually get perverse incentives. And some of you might have read in the Business Day there was an article about toilets, right? It costs basically 7,000 rand to build a new toilet. It takes 900 rand to clean it. But municipalities will rather build multiple toilets in one plot, right? Okay, because they can access grant funding to build a new toilet, but they would have to take cleaning the funds for cleaning out of the operating budgets, which they don't have, right? So that link or lack of a linkage between operating funding and capital funding can lead to extreme distortions. You also asked the question on, have we looked at who are the current occupants of houses as opposed to the initial beneficiaries? And unfortunately, we haven't found research on that. We will try and see if Human Settlements has research on it. We must say that the lack of transfer of title deeds also makes it very difficult to know who was the original beneficiary and who is the final occupant, because the title deed is linked to an ID number, and that's how you can make sure that one person is not being registered for more than one property. The minute you don't transfer those title deeds, then you can reach issues where people actually qualify multiple times for subsidies, basically on the same ID. The issue that you raised about the greenfields approach and viability of the greenfields approach, I think that is one of the areas that our study is going to be looking at for the next part of the hearings. But there is a feeling that the brownfields approach has actually been neglected, that you might actually find spaces which already have the infrastructure, or you know, could just be rehabilitated or revitalized. So that's an area that we definitely do want to look at. There was a question on eligibility for subsidies and foreigners. My understanding is that only foreigners with permanent residence are eligible for subsidies, right? I think that, you know, it is certainly the case that sometimes you might find that people who are not eligible do actually get those subsidies. So the question is, how are we making sure that those subsidies are appropriately targeted? The issue was raised on, okay, poor data, what do we do about it? And I think that we have two types of data. Data on the supply side, how many houses do we have, how many structures do we have, and then the demand side, what do people want? Right. Now, personally, I find it strange that we can't actually get good M&E data on the number of houses and structures, because from a monitoring and evaluating perspective, it's actually the easiest thing to actually monitor, because unlike health status, you know, which is difficult to ascertain, I mean, infrastructure is relatively easy to obtain. So why we cannot get data on completed houses and then houses in work in progress houses, you know, to me is like a bit strange. So I think that we should insist immediately on improving the supply side information on houses, because that is just a case of bad M&E. There's no inherent technical problem with measurement. I think that with the demand side, it's more difficult, partly because we do have information gaps, like on the rural areas, partly because of the migration issues that people have mentioned, right, okay? So, you know, when you're working with demand, you're practically always working with forecasts. And so, you know, how do you improve the credibility of that forecast actually becomes quite challenging. There was a question asked on redlining. Basically, the question was saying there is a practice among banks where they take a decision not to lend in a particular area. So they don't look at the applicant's risk profile. They actually just look at the area and then they refuse that application. Now, this is not an area that the FFC has done work in, but about a year and a half ago, National Treasury released a discussion paper. It was called Building a Better and More Stable Financial System in South Africa. And it introduces what is called colloquially the Twin Peaks model, right, for prudential regulation. And what that Twin Peaks model does is it says that banking prudential legislation stays with SARB, right? But what they would try and do is basically bring into one umbrella body all regulators which impact on consumers in the financial sector. So that would include the FSB, consumer protector, the long-term insurance association, short-term insurance association, etc. And those would focus on conduct in banking and financial sector, and also how consumers were actually treated. So the issues of redlining should actually come up with when they produce the white paper for how the new institutional arrangements are actually going to look like. And then there was a question from the chair about informal settlements, about the studies which show that in other countries you have graduation, but in South Africa we tend to find persisting informal settlements without that upgrade. And you'll see that we actually do quote some work. For example, Killett and Napier, it's a 1995 study, which compares South Africa with various places in South America. So I think that the challenge is to say, okay, now what can we learn from it? And how can we apply that to doing things differently? And I think that that sort of analysis, hopefully, is what we will be able to focus on in the second set of hearings.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. I think most of the questions have been covered, but I'll just add a bit more technical details to some of them. The issue of the data gaps, as the acting chairperson pointed out, it's only official Stats SA data that can be used for the formula. What was done was that we did look at some of the sample surveys that the honourable member was talking about, such as the General Housing Survey and those type of things. Unfortunately, the sample size is a bit too little to disaggregate the data at a local government level. So you can have it at provinces and at best districts. But the most comprehensive and accurate would be from a census. Even the 2007 community survey, which tried to fill a five-year gap with, I think it was 220,000 households, was also a bit skeptical as you disaggregated downwards. So that was some of the problem with the existing data that you have in updating the formula. I think when the initial formula was reviewed in 2005, I think the FFC did make a recommendation for an explicit link between the MIG and the equitable share for that purpose. And technically, it was tried. What it does is that you have that 130 or 135 rand subsidy that goes to households that are connected to services. And then you have a partial subsidy, a third of the 135, that goes to households that are not connected. So the thinking there was that if you have data updates, the more you eradicate your backlogs, then that would be updated in the formula, and then you would be getting more equitable share for operating expenditure. Unfortunately, because of data problem, that it's non-existent. So there is, like everyone said, no link at all between the two. And I think on the 130 rand, I think Commissioner Adam she captured it very well. It was initially 130. There was an adjustment to make it 135. For the increase in the electricity price in 2009, I think it was. But like Commissioner Adam says, it's just a technical feature, just to determine a municipality's share of a pool of revenue. So instead of going starting from one side and saying what are the costs and hence this is what's needed, it's what is needed and then we just use some costing to determine it. Just for the interest of the committee, if you had to take 135 rand subsidy and take all the households with services for all municipalities, it only, using the subsidy level of 135, it only equates to 6.7 billion. So what happens is that every year the total pool of equitable share increases by from 20 billion to 25 billion to 30 billion. So what this does is that it just takes your share of the 6.7 billion, say 20% for example, and then gives you the 20% of the 30 billion for the year. So it's just a feature, it's a technical feature that is being reviewed. I think most of the other questions were covered unless I missed.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for the
responses. Members, for the sake of time, Peter, I'll take you for a few seconds. Then.
Just this last issue, just for clarity, I'm a bit thick on this one. What we're saying is then, the free basic services are not actually funded by way of a grant amount that equates to the cost of services. What happens is, you determine the formula first, the grant, the total amount in aggregate, and then in the division they simply use this figure as a way of slicing that cake, but it doesn't bear any link to the cost. Do you have any idea what the cost would be if it were done in this manner? Or do you know what the costs are, in fact?
Of free basic services. I think this is coming if yes, sir. Is it all services this or is free basic only? Yeah, basic services.
Currently, at an aggregate level, we, as part of the review process, we are working on trying to determine what the actual cost of the basic services. But what, and I'm sure my commissioner can add, municipalities, some of them do know, even the national sector departments, you can get costing from them. So we're just trying to collate this information in our review process.
Just to also say that as part of the hearings, the local government, the second part of the hearings, we've also engaged a service provider to actually model what these costs would be, right? So that when we look at what are the different scenarios for moving forward, we actually understand what are the price tags that are attached to it. And so they will be modeling things like maintenance as well.
No, thanks ever so much for the presentation. I don't know, some of us received the recommendations, I think, long time ago, and the meeting between us to have some interaction that's long overdue. We tried to feature in ourselves inside. You were busy because of budget votes. First time we made an appointment, you were briefing cabinet, I'm told, so the second time with other portfolio committees. But tomorrow we are having our budget vote, but fortunately your documents and your recommendations we have, we tried to feature some of your recommendations as to augment yours as ours again, to just to sensitize, meaning that we understand very much your recommendations. We've put them in our reports, like our budget vote reports. There are some of your recommendations that we've put forward, and in our BRR reports, there are some of your recommendations that we tried to put forward. And I think in tomorrow's debate, in some of the areas that we'll be focusing on, we will be talking on some of the recommendations that you've put forward. Members, maybe let's allow for 1 minute, or maybe let's finish the meeting without any disturbance. If I allow them to go, we'll waste another 5 minutes. So just observe then and sit down, because you want to. I know members now are not seated here. Their hearts are on finalizing their speeches for tomorrow. So members, I plead with you, you've got 3 sets of minutes. Let's quickly go through them. We'll take the first one so that we'll manage to adopt. We are trying to avoid the situation which we are coming from of adopting many minutes at the second time. I think this is the last batch. Now we'll try by all means that we adopt minutes emanating from the previous meeting. We've got minutes of the 28th of February. Let's look at them. Page 1. Are there any corrections? Besides the surnames, spelling of surnames, Steenhuisen, Nkosi Mandela, I'm seeing that he was present in this meeting and he was not captured. Page 2. We're still on corrections. And maybe some additions that maybe at this minute the true reflection of that meeting. And we've agreed that the next set of meeting must reflect our discussions, not only the presentation. We agreed in our last meeting saying that the next set of meeting will come up with the questions and the responses, and we'll craft recommendations thereof, so that we'll know each and every presentation we received, what was our take and our recommendations thereof. So I think this is our last meeting we adopt without any discussions and recommendations. Page 3. If there is none, any mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 13th, of the 28th of February? That much up?
I propose the adoption of the minutes.
Any second of the adoption of the minutes?
Honorable Nami seconds the adoption of the minutes.
A second adoption.
The two Bonhome and the Boinami seconds the adoption of the minutes of the 28th. Let's get into minutes of the 6th of March. And also here are spellings on page 1, page 2. We check on corrections of spelling and capturing, is it the true reflection of all what was discussed or briefed on that meeting? Page 3. We deferred this item of adoption of minutes from last week's meeting, so we couldn't adopt them because of time. I'm assuming that members have already received the minutes and gone through them at their spare time. Ewen, do you want to come in?
Just something I just asked, man, in the light of what we said about recommendations, did we with the last set of minutes say that we need to remove the clause which said that recommendations would be found in the budget report? Did we take it out of there? Is it? Okay.
Any mover for the adoption of the minutes of the 6th of March?
Yeah, I want the president. I can move that. Okay.
John, you move for the adoption of me?
I move for the adoption, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Any seconder? Yeah. Honorable Sir Khaled Isai seconds. Thanks. The minutes of the 13th of March. From page 1. Which spelling is correct? Must correct the surname spelling. But mine, it's at last, it's corrected. They were spelling as if I made closer. Page 2. Page 3. Any mover for the adoption of the minutes? Honorable Boinam.
For the adoption of this minutes.
Thanks, Honorable Boinami. Any seconder for the adoption of the minutes? Mamdi Chatelo seconds the adoption of the minutes. Thanks, Honorable Members. I think all the minutes now will be adopting this today's meeting on the next portfolio committee meeting with our discussions, recommendations, and responses from each state entity that comes before the committee. Are there anything that I need to only to say? I wish you all the best in tomorrow's budget vote debate. All the speeches must be constructive. All the criticisms must be constructive. John, The meeting stays at Chair.
There's some clarity that I would like to. I don't know, is it only me that received? There's an invitation for Thursday from the minister. So I just want to find out.
As far as I know, May, until now we haven't received any invitation as a portfolio committee, as a chairperson's office, nor the WIPS office. So we haven't received any. Since we saw it from John and yourself, we haven't received it. That means we are not going, to be part of that meeting called by the department. Thanks.
John, see you tomorrow.
Yes, I will listen to you.
Okay. Maybe this is the first time that I'm going to say the same thing tomorrow.
Maybe you might have it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.